Hello and welcome to another episode of the Rethink Energy Podcast, where the Rethink Energy team talk about the technology behind this week's energy news. I'm your host yet again, our automotive and battery analyst, Connor Watts, and I'm joined again by our editor and hydrogen analyst, Bogdan Avramuta.
Hello everybody, good morning.
And by our solar analyst, Andries van den Aar.
Hello!
We're going to be talking primarily about three stories from this week's issue, which you can find on rethinkresearch.biz, that's .biz. The first of which being of how Norsk Hydro's plan is to increase its aluminium demand for the automotive industry despite relatively low prices. More or less the antithesis of what you'd normally see happening, but there is reasons as to why it's doing so. We're going to be talking about how European manufacturers of green steel are inadvertently benefiting from some of the chaos happening around the Suez Canal. And finally, we're going to be talking about how, over the Christmas period, Saudi Arabia has meddled with its siting allowances for renewable energy projects. And then finally, we're going to be talking about a couple short items from this week's issue as well. So to get into it, effectively, Norsk Hydro's plan, which is one of the largest aluminium producers in Europe and around the world, is to increase its aluminium production and to shift its product towards what is more so used towards the automotive sector, as opposed to what is used in other things like construction and more niche industries. And aluminium prices are quite low at the moment. They're not the lowest that they've ever been, but there is a bit of a green premium within the automotive sector in particular, just because of a general shortage of green aluminium. And to remedy this, Norsk Hydro is investing in a new recycling plant in the UK, which will also produce this heavily scrap-focused aluminium product for reuse in the automotive industry. And it's effectively saying that it expects significant growth in the automotive sector for aluminium, because of the effectively the shift towards electric vehicles. When you're, well, because of two main reasons, from what I know at least, the electric vehicles are obviously going to be a lot heavier because of the use of a battery, and so any weight losses you can gain are going to be efficiency gains in the long run, and they aren't necessarily going to be insignificant in efficiency gains if you can get the weight reduction down right. There's also that aluminium is used within the battery itself as a current collector. So it's one side is aluminium, the other side's copper. I forget which way around it is, so try not to crucify me too much for that. What this effectively means is that as electric vehicle uptake increases, so will aluminium demand, particularly with companies shifting towards the large casting and the giga casting of significant body parts like underbodies and chassis frames and that sort of thing. The short to medium demand of aluminium is very strong, according to Norsk Hydro, despite current low prices. But I have my doubts as to the long-term aluminium demand, mostly because aluminium as a structural material isn't the most efficient thing you can do, particularly when we're talking about the gigacasting of automotive body parts. So the automotive demand isn't, this is well into the future, by the way. This is, I'm talking very much about long-term demand here, so it's not got too much bearing on its current strategic decisions, but I would just say that Norsk Hydro doesn't want to entrench itself within this ecosystem and for the next few decades. And while the flexibility of aluminium means it really doesn't have to, it's making the decision now to shift into producing products for the automotive sector, but it could always unshift. It can always move back into other products where it sees demand increasing more proportionally.
So, but Connor, I know this is a long-term outlook that you're talking about, but are any current automotive OEMs showing signs of at least sniffing around this magnesium?
So as of right now, it's not so the automotive OEMs that are sniffing around magnesium, it's the producers of the gigacasters, and I believe Tesla might be looking at it. But again, this is more so the plans of a few small companies looking to increase the magnesium supply chain, because this technology effectively gives a new significant source of demand for it. Because magnesium right now isn't produced in significant quantities to be traded kind of globally on an exchange like aluminium. The demand for it just is not that high, and so the prices are very high. But that's mostly because a vast majority of it is still produced in the traditional ways from like back in the 1800s, when it was first kind of worked out how to separate elemental magnesium. There are better and cheaper ways to do that now with modern technology that just haven't really been explored, because the use case for elemental or alloyed magnesium products hasn't appeared. But with electric vehicles becoming more important and weight being a primary concern for automotive manufacturers, weight and cost. Yes, actually, weight, cost, and strength are the primary concerns for any automotive manufacturer looking at producing a vehicle. That's relatively fundamental analysis of the lighter the vehicle, the more efficient the battery is going to be, and the vehicle's efficiency, the motor efficiency, kind of power to output efficiency, all of these things increase as vehicle weight falls. Cost is evident, so the main problem becomes manufacturing simplicity. Now, when it comes to gigacasting, you can't just put molten and magnesium into a gigacasting mold like you can with aluminium and just turn it into a part, because there's difficulties with the flow of the material and the porosity of the end product, which creates structural weaknesses. It's a very niche technology as of right now. Later into this decade, I think we're going to be seeing more magnesium body parts cast out of these large machines that we're currently seeing making their way onto small body parts for companies like Tesla, and Toyota is looking at it as well. But that needs to be preceded by the supply chain, otherwise it can't happen on an economic scale. So either these companies need buying out and scaling so that the IP is being supported by a company with significant financial weight, or another use case needs to come up that's a lower level of complexity and one that won't be drowned out by kind of the size of the aluminium industry. That is to say, regardless of all of that, at scale, when you compare mechanical properties of aluminium and of alloyed magnesium, if you were to replace most of the body parts, the underbody, the wheels, effectively anything that's currently aluminium paneling, you can get upwards of an 8 to 10% increase in range by that alone, by the weight reductions. And you can increase the motor efficiency because the power to the wheels will be more efficient. It just has better kind of mechanical dampening effect. So the benefits are there, and any marginal benefit that can be found for EVs is quite significant. The other benefit here is that the costs to producing aluminium at scale with modern technology could very well be lower than that of mining kind of bauxite or recycling aluminium from scrap into a usable product again. So at the very least, it could very easily reach cost parity with that, because it's not cheap to mine aluminium, and processing aluminium and processing bauxite isn't cheap either. It's very energy intensive. So the benefits are clearly there. It's just very, very infantile, even for something that we look at. I would liken it to Andreessen's immense knowledge of perovskites in the solar industry. It's very early stage.
So is that across gigacasting and thixo molding, or are they not the dramatic part here?
Thixo molding isn't the same as gigacasting, because effectively you use a semi-molten material as opposed to a fully molten material. That, in the case of magnesium, improves the kind of laminar flow, and it generally just, it's a method that's almost an addendum to gigacasting. So a company called Idra at the moment, that's the main company producing the gigacasting presses, which are these big, those are the big massive machines that you see when we're talking about the gigacasting. They're the company that produce the presses, which produce these components, and they are looking at introducing thixo molding as an addendum to gigacasting, which would allow greater material choices. So aluminium is a standard right now because it's commonly used within the industry. It works reasonably well with gigacasting because you can just melt the material. But magnesium, again, has superior mechanical properties, and as a bonus, when you're talking about using a semi-molten material versus a fully molten material, we're talking about less energy costs. And so the fixo molding side of it is just the technical term for semi-molten part casting through this large pressing mechanism. We can effectively be talking about like molten casting or semi-molten casting or forging of parts, and you can look at the different costs associated with that. And at scale, fixo molding magnesium looks to be the best option available on the market in the long term. When we're talking about the availability of current structural materials for the automotive industry.
So what's like the limiting or determining factor of market share between aluminium and magnesium? Is it the technology? Is it the supply?
So the supply of magnesium is infinitesimally smaller as of right now. It's not used in significant capacity.
I proofed that yesterday and I already forgot. Yes.
The current supply is infinitesimally smaller, but that's because we're using old techniques from the 1800s to produce it. Mm. And so there is a few companies working on these new methods of producing aluminium, which is supposed to be lower cost. Whether or not they can realize these lower costs is going to be a factor of capital investment and the technological validity of these plans, which I'd like to talk with them soon. So Magrafeer, if you're listening.
So it's basically a Western thing, I'm guessing, and not a Chinese thing?
It's primarily a Western thing, weirdly enough. But I wouldn't be surprised if there's a Chinese company that I don't know about looking at producing magnesium. So it's a Western thing that I know about as of right now. I'm going to be doing more research on this in the coming future, so expect to hear about it again. Moving on. So Bogdan, we're all fairly familiar with the Houthi attacks at the other end of the Suez Canal, the Gulf of Aden. This is negative. So this is rather perversely a good thing for European green steel. Can you elaborate on that?
Well, yeah, it's I guess, as you pointed it out, a bad thing has, I guess, positive repercussions on the European energy generation sector, which is really similar to what we saw in the last couple of years post Russian invasion of Ukraine. And it's really a conflicting conclusion, I suppose. But this time around, the troubles around the Gulf of Aden disrupting trade through the Suez Canal meant that a lot of ships had to go around Africa, around the Cape of Good Hope. And that obviously adds to the cost of the fuel. Now we saw the price per ton of steel from Asian steelmakers exporting steel to Europe increased by around $75 per ton, which, depending on how much the steel costs, can be around maybe 10, maybe even 15% of the total cost, which is quite drastic. And essentially what we see in the steel industry right now, it's a bit of a momentum shift. Green steel, as we know, the steel manufactured with the use of green hydrogen, which does not produce emissions. So low carbon steel. So plenty of investment right at the beginning of the year. About 4.5 billion euros were secured by H2 Green Steel, the Swedish green steel manufacturer startup that's building a green steel facility in Boden, Sweden. The German, and now apologies for butchering this name, but I'm sure I will, ThyssenKrupp Nucera, the electrolyzer manufacturer, ThyssenKrupp Nucera is a bigger corporation, which also has a steel company. Under its name, ThyssenKrupp Steel Europe has released a tender seeking up to 151,000 tons of clean hydrogen per year to be used in its steel mill in Germany, in Duisburg. So big numbers thrown around the green steel sector, and now we see fossil-based steel imported by Europe from Asia being hit by a lot of those supply chain and trade disruptions. And we released a Green Steel Financial Assessment report early early last year in 2023. And really what we pointed out there is that all of those things, cost of supply chain increasing, trade disruptions, essentially fossil fuel prices going up, will essentially bridge that gap because people are concerned that green steel is going to be significantly expensive compared to traditional methods of steel manufacturing because of the premium they need to pay for green hydrogen. And we pointed out that there's two things that are going to bridge the gap. One is the cost of hydrogen dropping, and the other one is being the cost of traditional steel increasing because of these issues that I just mentioned. And this is a prime example of that.
Yeah, while obviously predicting wars and such isn't our area of expertise, I think it's always quite fair to assume, as of right now, that trade disruptions are going to be increasing and countries are moving towards a more isolationist approach, a more self-sufficient approach.
I mean, we can ask just how long will it take to actually clear Yemen, if that's even possible.
That's not a
well, I'll speak for
point to ask, is it?
I love it. I follow it a lot. And Israel might get stuck into Hezbollah next. So it could go on for years, just like the UK.
Andrew, it's not the time. Technology. Sure. So we're talking more so about just increased isolationism. We have the US isolating itself from the IRA. We have Europe trying to become more self-dependent from China. We're seeing China rapidly trying to isolate its own supply chain so they can continue to export. So perversely, the only massive trade partner with regards to those three is embracing kind of globalization is China, and that's obviously because it's making a lot of money from it. But yeah, when we're talking about the localization of supply chains, hydrogen wins out quite well because of the ability to produce it from multiple different energy sources. Now electrification also wins out from that, so the competition isn't necessarily warped in hydrogen's favor. But when we're talking about traditional things like the mining of coal to then produce steel using fossil fuels, then you have to mine that coal somewhere, which often isn't where you're producing the green steel. And the best places to be able to do that is in Asia. They've traditionally been able to export said steel around the world at relatively low prices because they have the lowest cost of production and transport wasn't a significant cost as part of that. But coal prices are currently quite high. I believe they're at about $135 a ton as of right now, if my memory serves me right. And so that's increased. Transport costs are increasing because of increasing geopolitical tensions in the Gulf of Aden. And that's not to say that there's not going to be more significant disruptions, particularly as, well, annoyingly, we're nearing election cycles and such. So I'm not saying expect the unexpected, but it's prudent to be able to put yourself in a position where the localization of your supply chain isn't going to hurt you. And when it comes to renewable energy deployment, that is the definition of energy independence. The sun and the wind aren't particularly geographically, they're not picky. There's obviously more efficient locations for certain types of energy and such, but at the end of the day, everywhere gets sun, everywhere gets wind.
And I suppose extra transportation costs from sailing around Africa are disproportionately heavy for basic goods like steel.
Yeah.
Do we actually have a figure in this article? I forget if we do.
We wouldn't be talking about this if we were talking about semiconductors or
I don't know,
like rare earth elements. Something that's incredibly value dense as a proportion of something that's incredibly value dense isn't particularly affected by transport costs apart from for other reasons. So if it's can't be compressed or if it can't be kept within a certain area, then that's obviously a mitigating factor. But if we're talking about transporting steel versus diamonds, steel is going to be disproportionately more affected by transport costs.
Of course, no, I agree with that. And that kind of links to another one of our conclusions, funnily enough, from a hydrogen transportation report that they touched on the green steel sector a bit. Essentially, what we're starting to see is because you mentioned Europe used to, or rather imports of the coal from Asia. It's the same thing with iron ore, right? But there's a couple of the deposits in Latin America. and even Canada. And then we see the same company that I talked about, H2 Green Steel, is essentially building an iron reduction facility in Canada to source right next to the source of iron ore. So essentially, what the green steel method of manufacturing is, you take the iron ore and you reduce it with hydrogen without emissions, right? And then the reduced iron is lighter than the raw iron ore. So you actually, if you do that at the point of sourcing the iron ore, you end up shipping just the iron, the reduced iron rather, sorry. That's actually lower weight than shipping the hydrogen and shipping the raw iron ore to, say, Europe and then reducing the iron ore in Europe.
So the production of green steel is also more efficient from a transport perspective because it's a different production process, is what you're saying.
Yeah, essentially, I guess what because the reduction of fire these days is mostly used with achieved through the use of natural gas.
Mm.
Today's natural gas supply chain, because natural gas obviously is, you know, volatility aside, is a cheap fuel.
Mm.
So Europe is used to just bringing it inland. And same thing with iron ore. So everything is done in Europe. But I guess, yes, hydrogen opens up those possibilities of actually you don't need to ship the fuel and you don't need to ship the iron ore, which is heavier than the reduced iron. You can just reduce it to the point of, you know, where you're lucky enough to get both iron ore and those renewable energy resources that you mentioned, wind or solar. So Canada, prime example for good wind, not so much for solar, but iron ore plus wind, you get hydrogen, you reduce the iron ore, and then you just shift the reduced iron, which really only needs to be melted into steel.
Right, fair enough. I would like to just correct myself on the price earlier. The price of coal is currently about 100 USD per ton. The price of iron is about 135. That's where I got wrong. But it has been abnormally high since COVID-19, and there was a long period during in the middle of 2021 to the, yeah, there's been a long period from the middle of 2021 to the end of 2022 where coal prices were extraordinarily high, maybe 6 or 7 times that of what they used to be. Okay, moving on. So Andreas, what's happened with regards to Saudi Arabia and its renewable deployment? We've seen somewhat recently a lot of promises, not too much action. Is this a way to remedy that?
Well, to be perfectly honest, at first I thought I was writing a filler article here. But then I saw that it wasn't just, oh yes, we're looking at 1,200 sites across the country for wind and solar, which is moderately interesting, but not necessarily worth a full article. It's also that you've got this energy minister, Abdulaziz bin Salman Al Saud. I thought that guy was also the crown prince, but maybe it's slightly different. Anyway, he announced those 1,200 sites at the Digital Forum in Riyadh in December. Then in January, he said something similar, this time to a mining conference, saying we're serving every corner of the kingdom and we want to deliver green electricity and green hydrogen to almost the home address of whoever wants it. And we're exploring for lithium and rare earth metal. You would know more about that than me. But it sounds like certainly the rhetoric has amped up. And we always used to say that Saudi's infrastructure announcements are grandiose and unreliable. I think that that's probably still true, but that would mean that if they're not making grandiose announcements, that definitely nothing's going to happen. And then when they start making the grandiose announcements, something is going to happen. And we do have some hard data to go on, as in wind and solar plants that have actually been built. They do now have the first few big wind and solar farms being commissioned, really ever, mostly in the past year. Like most of the capacity, I believe, is from then. And so maybe it's about to ramp up dramatically. And you look at the wind pipeline is 1.8 gigawatts. I'm not actually sure what the solar pipeline is, but it's definitely several times that. And just a few years back in 2019 and 2017, the Saudis were running like, here's our 2.7 megawatt single turbine, wind turbine that we've got as a pilot trial, which is just ridiculous for that late in the game. So they're definitely further ahead than they used to be. Let's put it like that. So that's about it, really. I mean, this country has some obstacles, like they have a limitation on
workforce, you have to employ about 50% locals. So they're not, as I used to think that they just would use enormous amounts of Indian labor, and I thought that's why they had the same record low project costs as India. But it's not quite like that. I guess it would be Bangladesh and Pakistan as well, because you know they've got some local requirements. And obviously they have plenty of space and they have plenty of money. So pretty good prognosis. But I think for now, probably the domestic installations are probably ironically outscaled by what their own company, Aqua Power, and what the UAE's company, what's their one? I forget the equivalent one from the UAE. I think they're probably building more in Central Asia right now, in like Uzbekistan. But maybe that will change quite soon. And we do think that the oil peak oil is going to be reached at some point. Maybe what's our latest view on that? 2030? Earlier than that. Okay.
I brought up this article anyways, just because it's interesting to see how Saudi is changing its tune with regards to renewables. I think it's good to keep track of it.
Oh, and I just remembered one more actual concrete thing that I have to mention, because so much of what I just said was generalities. They did actually, now where is it now? They did eliminate energy subsidies in 2022. And I think that might explain why in 2023 you saw a lot of the big utility stuff come online. Might be not a complete coincidence. It also means that you can build self-consumption rooftop solar and have it actually make sense instead of being completely absurd. Go ahead.
I was just effectively saying that it's interesting to keep track of Saudi's shift towards renewables, because just this is moving into the kind of a point that I made now worth noting, is that Saudi Arabia has abandoned its plans to increase its oil production capacity to 13 million barrels per day, up from its current 12. So it is shifting towards the use of renewables, and as you mentioned earlier with regards to exploring for lithium and for rare earth metals, it's slowly working out and changing its rhetoric to say oil is not the future, which is fairly comforting for us and hopefully most of the world. Its reasoning for reducing for cancelling its planned production expansion capacity was that it wasn't able to effectively monetize its existing capacity. So, as of right now, Saudi doesn't produce its full capacity of oil. I don't have an exact number to hand, but recently, at least, it cut production fairly significantly, and it did it in stages quite a lot last year alongside Russia. And so that's kept OPEC's production relatively muted, while other sources like the US and Norway are operating at functionally maximum capacity to be able to supply oil markets the just the additional oil that means that supply won't become significantly constrained and price will shoot up, because that would help Russia fairly significantly and it would give more money to Saudi that it hasn't earned. So you've got that current dynamic ongoing in that Saudi and Russia want to continue cutting oil production, but as it does that, OPEC matters less and less. So unless something significant happens with regards to US and Norwegian oil production and supply into global markets, we can't see Saudi even returning to significantly higher levels of oil production, because it doesn't have the economics in its favor to be able to do so as of right now.
And that means they have to have hydrogen, probably. Is there any alternative? I guess they could try and have every other industry as well.
It depends on what exactly it finds with regards to its lithium and its rare earth and things. I remember it was looking specifically for lithium, rare earths, graphite, phosphate. It basically went into a grab bag of all the battery metals and the kind of new energy materials and said, this is what we're looking for, as if it had any reasoning to be able to do so. But they do have a state mining company that was handled by the oil side of things, and I wouldn't be surprised if they made a shock move for a direct lithium extraction technology company, because when it comes to processing brines and such, you see companies like Exxon in the US, they're they're taking a brine resource and trying to produce lithium out of that to then supply it to Tesla. So you've got that particular interesting mashup of companies. But oil companies are very good at taking things out of the ground and processing it into something useful. It's not, well, the processing of lithium brines versus the processing of oil is very different, but it's also got a lot of similarities that means there's a lot of transferable expertise there. I wouldn't be too surprised if Saudi does become relatively good at that. It's whether or not the geopolitical tensions and its allies and friendships position it well to be able to supply into major demand centers. It's a question of when companies and when countries are suddenly less reliant on Saudi for oil and such, whether or not they still decide to deal with an autocratic regime. But that's not really for us to answer. So, and economics tends to win out in those regards anyways. So moving on to the last point with regards to our worth noting section. There's been two not so good pieces of news within the battery sector recently that I feel like I should address. Both Renault and PowerCo, and by Renault I mean Renault's electric vehicle focused Ampere unit and PowerCo, are delaying their IPOs for the foreseeable future. Now, this is broadly due to market conditionings worsening. So 2023 was the single worst year in IPO numbers for the last 10 years, which isn't overly surprising considering that measures from 2014 to 2024, but even losing out to pandemic years should be a bit of a worry. But this is purely due to the current like debt environment and such. So with interest rates being as high as they are and then being maintained, it's difficult to IPO into a favorable position. So they're delaying that for the foreseeable future, but it's important to say that both Renault's Ampere unit and PowerCo are still maintaining their current production timelines. Neither company is scaling back production. It just isn't sourcing. It isn't rapidly increasing its private funding to be able to kind of scale at a more rapid rate to be able to meet its competition, as it were. It's seeing an industry slowdown, slowing down the IPO, so it's to time it a little better with like market forces and such. And it's a strategic decision that isn't really that isn't as much of an indictment of the state of the electric vehicle industry as a lot of people want.
I remember you saying quite explicitly in an article 1 or 2 weeks back that the weakness of one or two Western companies doesn't reflect on the EV market. It just reflects on them not being as good as the Chinese ones, to put it bluntly.
That will have been Ford producing a lot of pickup trucks that cost far too much and nobody particularly wants past a certain kind of niche subsector of the American market. Yeah. Meanwhile, the European companies are doing a little bit better.
So, but does this reflect continuing to? What about the US market? Hang on, China selling EVs into the US? Is it sort of allowed to?
Not really. It's allowed to, but if it wants to take significant tariffs on any vehicle sold,
which sometimes it can and still be cost effective. But it's not the biggest market anyway. This Renault and Ampere EV stuff could be partly because Europe isn't having a great time economically.
It's mostly because of the debt environment. Yeah, Europe's not doing incredibly economically, but the automotive markets have recovered mostly from post-COVID. So, and increasing EV deployments as well EV deployments are continuing to increase. As Europe has the added issue of Chinese competitors, because it doesn't have a way to decouple itself from Chinese battery manufacturing and investment, because that's already taking a pretty significant stranglehold on Eastern Europe. And I don't want to be the one who has to tell Poland, Hungary, Romania, and Slovakia that they suddenly can't take all this Chinese money and we don't have anything to replace it. So it's difficult. It's in a position where it will be competing with Chinese companies, as you say, while America won't be. The problem with America is that they are so goddamn far behind, other than maybe Tesla, that they, even with tariffs, some Chinese companies are trying to compete within North America. And these are like 27% and up it's not good. But yeah, that's not including IRA subsidies. And there's still companies trying to compete because there's a massive market opening for just mid-sized and smaller electric vehicles. It's not all about the pickups in America. Yes, they're important, but they need to come down in cost first. And to do that, you need significant production of them. And you can't put significant production of them at a high cost, so focus on the mid-market segment first.
There is a couple of little notes from the end of the issue that I'd like to bring up. One is that NextWafe, it has established an American subsidiary for making wafers, solar wafers. And that's remarkable for a couple of reasons. One is that as you get further up the supply chain, leaving out polysilicon, which still exists from ages ago in the West. So basically wafers has proven a bit difficult to get going because you can only really build it when there's cells ready to use. And you can only build the cells once there's modules ready to use in a protected market. So it's like a sequential delay for each step. And then the wafer step in particular is pretty high on investment cost. And maybe there's even a problem that China having 98% market share means that maybe the West doesn't even have that much expertise anymore. I'm sure we perfectly understand the Joukowsky process and so on in terms of the science, but in terms of manufacturing, practical manufacturing upscaling, we may actually be at a sort of expertise gap. I should ask NextWave about them next time I interview them, but I've already interviewed them in June, and it was a really good one. So I'm just telling our listeners that maybe they should go back and read it. It's a bit unusual, especially since they're not doing the Joukowsky process anyway. They're actually doing their own epitaxy process. So instead of Joukowsky, where you melt a whole load of polysilicon, and I think it's 1400 degrees, and then you slowly and painfully pull it out into a monocrystalline ingot, and then you cut that up, they just deposit it into the wafers directly, which is quite, it's very different. I'm sure it must be much more technically challenging, otherwise everyone would do it because it is less, it's less energy intensive. So that's one interesting.
I imagine it'll also be quite heavily patented.
Oh, yes. Actually, so... I seem to remember that. I think the word patent comes up a few times in that article from June.
You'd hope so anyways. All right, well. That's, I believe, all we have time for today. So we do have more articles on our website. Again, that's rethinkresearch.biz. You'll be prompted to take a trial. It's more so about the forecast, but the articles are interesting anyways. And we'll be talking about that more again next week. We should also have another episode of Rethink Energy Talks on its way out, so stay tuned for that. We'd like to thank all of our listeners for tuning in today, and we hope that you return to us again next week. So goodbye for now.